Hello and welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Inheritors by William Golding. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Rebecca Ragg Sykes, an archaeologist and honorary fellow in the School of Archaeology, Classics, and Egyptology at the University of Liverpool. She's the author of Kindred, Neanderthal Life, Love, Death, and Art, which comes out this June in paperback in the United States. She joins us by Zoom from Wales as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station WRFH in Michigan. Rebecca, welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Why is The Inheritors by William Golding a great book?
Oh, because there's so much in this book to talk about. It is a great book because when it was written in the 1950s, there was really nothing else that had been like it, I don't think. It's a story about Neanderthals and Homo sapiens people, so people like us, and a meeting between them in an unspecified time and place. And we see it from both perspectives. And the language is incredible, the ideas are incredible, and it's just unique.
We're going to talk about all of that. We're talking about this book, its story, its characters, as well as other caveman classics of literature, we might say. The science of Neanderthals we're going to get into and a lot more. But let's start with the very first chapter, the very first scene in The Inheritors, this novel from 1955. We meet the main characters in this book as they try to cross a river so they can reach their summer territory. Rebecca, tell us what's going on here.
Yeah, so this is a group of, we sort of gradually realize, are Neanderthals. They've come from their seasonal living place by the sea. We sort of gradually learn this. We're kind of sort of placed down in the midst of their experience and their emotions. And you only really realize what's happening in the broader context as the story goes on. But at the beginning, they're coming from the sea up to a place, sort of an overhang, a rock shelter where they live up in the mountains, and they've been traveling. And they arrive to this place they know well, which is a river, where there should be a log for them to cross because they're frightened of water. But the log has gone. And essentially, there's only a small group of them, about five or six, I think. And they are faced with this conundrum of how do we cross? And they try to overcome the river by adding a new log, but it kind of just all goes wrong. And the what becomes obvious is the elder male of their group, Mal, he falls in the river. And from that point onwards, the story gradually becomes more and more dark. But it's the fall, the literal fall of Mal into the river, that begins the fall of their entire group and their society. And it spins out to the rest of the story.
It's written from their perspective, which creates kind of challenge for William Golding, who I might add is the author of The Lord of the Flies. This was his follow-up novel to that classic work of fiction. The book is written from the perspective of these Neanderthal people, and I doubt there are people who, readers who pick this up and don't know it's about Neanderthals, but he certainly doesn't tell you this is a book about Neanderthals. There's not an expository paragraph on page two or anything like that. How do we realize that these are Neanderthal people?
Well, I mean, I think it's an interesting point that really, you could sort of imagine that it's set in any time and place where the people that we're looking at are hunting and gathering people. Sort of there's a context of a land where there's very few humans about. So in a sense, it's never really made explicit that these are Neanderthals at all. I think, you know, we understand that because of the author and the context and everything that's been written about it since. But if you purely take the book and you read it, it's not clear at all. Then you see everything from the perspective of Locke, who's the protagonist. He's a male Neanderthal, and he kind of personifies the essence of what makes the Neanderthals in this book different to Homo sapiens, in that he is almost entirely lives in the present. He's immensely sort of driven by his emotions and his feelings, and his way of thinking is highly visual. They sort of talk about pictures all the time. Pictures can mean memories and it can mean ideas in the future, but it's almost very immediate. There's like an impression that they struggle to put different thoughts together and come up with sort of complex processes. And you see everything from this perspective of Locke, who is the most like that out of all the members of his group. And it's only really at the end of the book, you know, not to, to make a spoiler for everybody listening, but at the end, it completely shifts and you see things from the perspective of the Homo sapiens people who they meet. And for those people, they barely even see the Neanderthals as humans. They describe them as sort of devils. They call them devils because they're very frightened of them. And they see a distinct sort of bestial character in these beings that they've encountered. So if you only read the book and take those two perspectives on it, it wouldn't be clear at all that it's actually Neanderthals. But it's so vivid all the way through. And I think that's the challenge, you know, as you say, that Golding has, is to how to write these characters and this world without actually giving away the secret that this is what it's about. It's about Neanderthals and us, you know, tens of millennia ago.
This small Neanderthal group who are at the center of the Inheritors call themselves the people. And then the Homo sapiens they meet, the modern humans they meet, are the new people. And there's a clash coming. We'll get to that in a moment. Tell us a little bit more about the people. We've learned about Mal, this aging leader. He falls in the river. Locke, who's this male character, lives in the moment. There's a woman called Fa. She's kind of the companion of Locke. I don't know that they're married. I don't even know if they have marriage, but they're together. She's very practical. What do we learn about the people, the Neanderthals? What are they like?
Well, this is a really small group. There is, as you say, there's Locke, Farr, who's a woman, Mal, who's an older man. There's also someone who's just referred to as the old woman, but you actually find out halfway through, almost as an aside, that she's actually Locke's mother. But he kind of is in awe of her. There's another woman called Nil who has a young baby, like an infant. And there's also a child called Liku, who is Locke and Farr's child. It's implied that she's their child. So it's a tiny group. And there's also a male called Ha, who we think is the father of Nil's baby. So it's a really tiny little group. But there is an implication that there used to be more of them. And it's not sort of made clear whether that's recently or in the deep past, but certainly by the time they encounter this other group of humans, it is a huge shock to them. They literally can't compute that there is anybody else in the world. They believe that they are the only people in the world.
There's an innocence to them too, right? They're mild, they're gentle, they're peaceful people.
Yeah, I mean, there's disagreement between them. It's really fascinating how Golding sort of is able to write about them being transparently emotional with each other, caring. There is some disagreements. You know, they sort of try and make decisions about things and some of them don't agree. Far, as you say, she's practical. She's also actually the cleverest out of the group. They have this belief that they explicitly say that men, a man for pictures, as in a man for thinking things, and a woman for what they call Oar, which is like this notion of like a spiritual presence of the earth. It's kind of like life force, but they see that personified in natural things. Like they see old pieces of glacier and they call them ice women. And the child, Liku, there's a root that Locke finds and gives to her, and it looks like a woman. And they call that the little Oar. So it's almost like sort of an emergent sort of idea of a goddess, but it's not so formalized. And so Far has this element, as well as being clever, she is a woman. And so she's kind of linked to this sort of more spiritual side. And the old woman also personifies that. But as the story goes on, the group shrinks and shrinks, and you find out it's actually the fault largely of these other people, the Homo sapiens people, they're causing this. And eventually you're left with Locke and Farr, and the two children have actually been stolen by the Homo sapiens group. And then it really starts to kind of ramp up and the action becomes more intense, and it's very, very anxious, and they basically try to get them back. And it doesn't go well. And by the end of the book, you have this really dramatic perspective shift, and you're suddenly within the group of the Homo sapiens looking at Locke left behind by himself. This kind of just creature that they see running along the riverbanks, and sort of the actual narration is totally different. The language is totally different, and the character of the book has shifted as well. But in terms of the group of the people, the character of that group is also completely altered. They are much more recognizably like people in any kind of novel. They're talking to each other in complicated language. There is much more sort of sophisticated ideas and thoughts and relationships. So the comparison with the Neanderthals is really, really stark, but you only get to that point by the end of the book.
And these are the new people, the modern humans, essentially, the Homo sapiens. These are our direct ancestors, I suppose. They're smart. They're also violent, cruel. They use weapons and fire, and so forth. What are we to make of them? Are they the villains of this book?
Well, it is kind of hard to not read it that way. I mean, the Neanderthal group, they have some technology. They can use fire, but they can't make it. They sort of seem to get on a bit better with each other. You know, I'm saying as if they have little disagreements, but there is a feeling that they're like a little, you know, a team. And they all sleep together in a bundle. There's no overt violence between them. Whereas when they encounter the Homo sapiens group, the new people, the first thing that happens is that the Neanderthals begin to disappear, and you realize that actually they have been done in by the Homo sapiens group. Then the children are abducted. Then the old woman is killed, and it's quite obvious that's what's happened. And then later on, when Locke and Farr are sort of hiding and spying on the Homo sapiens group, trying to get their children back, basically, they witness unbelievable things to them. So they see them making structures which they don't understand, like sort of houses basically built out of trees. They see them wearing clothes which they don't understand. They think that's actually their skin to begin with, till they see them take it off. They see them making fire, and also they have alcohol. They have two different kinds of alcohol, one of which seems to be mead. And all of these things are initially incomprehensible to the Neanderthals. But sort of worst of all is that the group has a real aura of threat and violence about them. And the way that that's communicated by Golding is really sort of through imagery. He describes the things that they do, then there's violence and disagreement, and there's what almost sounds like a rape scene as well. It's a little bit uncertain as what's going on there. That's between two of the Homo sapiens characters. But the way he describes them physically as well, from the perspective of the Neanderthals, is fascinating. He talks about the heads looking like bone because they have very white skin. And this is something we can come to with the science, that what they thought at the time in the 1950s about what Neanderthals might look like versus Homo sapiens people is reflective of attitudes we might not agree with now. But from the Neanderthals' perspective in this story, the people are unbelievably white looking. And so they think they have like bone heads, but there's something threatening about that. Then they start to talk about them as sort of having a texture of their skin like fungus. And then there's this, you sort of get this idea that something a bit rotten about these people. And it connects as well to the alcohol, which kind of has a smell of rotting honey. And then some of the imagery that Golding sort of draws out begins to get very threatening. For example, they talk about their teeth as has something remembering the wolves about it, because they've got pointed canines. This is the Homo sapiens people. This is not the Neanderthals. So actually, the Neanderthals, although everything that's new and unexpected about these people is intriguing and enticing, they also can feel a threat there. And it's like an immediate threat, but also Golding is trying to communicate that there is an existential threat there as well.
Now let's turn to the science, and we'll do it by way of the epigraph to the inheritors. So at the start of the William Golding novel, there's this statement from H.G. Wells from his book, The Outline of History. I'm going to read part of it. This is the line from Outline of History. Quote, "We know little of the appearance of the Neanderthal man, but this seems to suggest an extreme hairiness, an ugliness, or a repulsive strangeness in his appearance over and above his low forehead, his beetle brows, his ape neck, and his inferior stature," unquote. And it goes on to suggest that maybe Neanderthals are the source of ogres in our folklore. What are we to make of that epigraph? Does this describe the people from the book? And what does science have to say about all that?
Well, I find this really interesting that that is quite already in the 1950s, that was almost an old-fashioned way of thinking about Neanderthals, actually. I think there were sort of, if you look at some reconstruction images, for example, from the 50s and the 60s, not everybody was thinking about Neanderthals like that. Golding himself actually, you know, was interested in archaeology. And so I think he's actually intentionally drawing on older tropes of Neanderthals to sort of not depict them as archaeologists, even in the 50s, necessarily thought they were like, but kind of to create this idea of more like an other with a capital O sort of frightening creature that would be a character. I don't actually think he is trying to say this is the up-to-date idea of what Neanderthals are like. For example, he describes them explicitly as having like an opposable toe, like chimpanzees. And that was obviously well known that that wasn't the case by the time he wrote that. But I don't think it's an accident that he does it. I think he's kind of projecting this this fear of this sort of primitive creation that we've produced in our own minds, actually. So that's really interesting to sort of think about the reality, the archaeological reality versus the story. And similarly, the new people in his book, the Homo sapiens, people who meet the Neanderthals, they have pottery. That's not the case. So again, I think he's playing a little bit intentionally with sort of the history in order to make the broader points that he wants to make about encounters and sort of modernity versus innocence and things like this.
So let's for a moment set aside the inheritors and what it says about Neanderthals and modern humans. And Rebecca, just tell us, give us a primer on Neanderthals. And I should just add, I said at the top of the show, you're the author of Kindred, Neanderthal Life, Love, Death, and Art, a great new book coming out in paperback next month here in the United States, a great book on all of this. Give us a quick primer on the Neanderthals, about what we know about them now. Who were they? When did they live? Where did they live?
Okay, well, we're nearly 70 years ahead of when The Inheritors was written. And obviously, we have, you know, moved ahead enormously in terms of how we understand archaeology, the deep past, how old everything is. So Neanderthals now, what we understand about them, they are an ancient close relative of Homo sapiens, but we shared a common ancestor with their lineage somewhere between 500,000 and 750,000 years ago, which sounds a long time, but in fact, in human evolutionary terms, that's pretty recent. It's not several million years ago. So they're actually very closely related to us. And it looks like they emerged as a population, a distinct population, around about sort of 400,000 to 350,000 years ago in Eurasia, Western Eurasia. So they didn't emerge, as far as we understand, from the African continent. That's where we were sort of evolving ourselves from populations that were connected there. So they live as hunter-gatherers. They are actually really capable hunters, which is not the case in the book at all. Technologically, they are really, really sort of capable in all different kinds of materials. They work stone, they work wood. We can see beautifully finely worked spears. And there wasn't just one way to be a Neanderthal. So they live all the way from this early period when they emerge right through to when they disappear about 40,000 years ago. And through that time, they actually deal with many different phases of climate change. So they're always associated in people's minds with really cold glacial conditions, but actually they live during warm times like we're in now, where you have forests even a few degrees warmer. So you have Neanderthals in a world with hippopotamuses, as well as Neanderthals in another world with mammoths. So they are another kind of human. They were very successful. We know an enormous amount about them. We've got skeletal remains from probably something like 200 individuals, from, you know, infants right through to older adults. So we actually know a lot about them. They're the closest to us in an evolutionary sense, and we also have the richest record for them archaeologically.
You just called them another kind of human. Is that a useful way of thinking about them as human beings?
I think it's the only way to think about them. They're so closely related to us, in terms of, you know, the evolutionary context. We know that we could interbreed with them. And, you know, genetics is something that's appeared for Neanderthals. We've only had that 12 years, but the amount that we can tell from ancient DNA is incredible. And one of those things is that there was some interbreeding, and some of those hybrid children were able to go on and then have their own children over the generations. And that's the genetic legacy we have in all living people, have some Neanderthal DNA. So they have to be quite close to us. But as well as that, you just have to look at the archaeological record. Everything we can see is that they were living complicated lives in technological terms, in how they organized themselves through the landscape, the ways that they hunted, how selective they were about the materials they used. They're very interested in the properties of things. There's even an emergent impression of an aesthetic sense, an interest in color and changing surfaces and things like this.
So what do we know about their art? And I might ask, what do we know about their storytelling and their literature, which is probably nothing for sure, at least. But what can we say about their art and this part of their lives?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing. You know, we talk about the DNA as, you know, and I talk about the DNA as being like there is a literal material connection between everybody alive today and the Neanderthals in our bodies and our blood. But it's also an intriguing idea that, you know, people, humans, have been telling stories for tens of millennia, probably hundreds of millennia. You know, so there's like a chain of words that goes back into time as well. We do believe Neanderthals had some form of vocal communication, some kind of talking that was important to them in their everyday lives. But we don't know the content of that language. We don't know if they could tell each other stories. In the book, it says, you know, the people rarely dreamed, but they're able to actually tell each other about the dreams that they have. We don't really know if Neanderthals could do that, although they certainly would have dreamed. All sorts of animals dream. So those are really intriguing questions that are very hard to actually answer. But in terms of their sort of aesthetics and their interest in materials, you know, we can see that they are using colour for different things. Sometimes we can have sites where we have just collections of mineral pigments. In other places, we see them using pigments on unusual objects, for example, a fossil shell, which doesn't have any connection to subsistence. It's an unusual object. Or an eagle's talon. And in this case, which is from a Croatian site, you have a mix of pigments on that object. So the objects that sort of we find from Neanderthal contexts, there's not so many of them. There's no clear shared sort of artistic tradition between sites, but these little individual unique cases, we see them in many times and places for Neanderthals. So there is something going on there, but the nature of it seems to be rather different to what we see in early Homo sapiens people, even sort of around the same time as Neanderthals were living. And sort of Neanderthals are creating incised series of engraved lines on bones. Early Homo sapiens people in Africa are doing something similar, but they're doing it more. It's like a hyped up version. There's more graphical structure to the things that they create, things like this. So there really is a difference there.
So what happened to the Neanderthals? Part of me says they went extinct, right? Or did they, if they in fact live on in us, in all of us, to a certain extent? What happened?
Well, this is one of the things where science kind of runs up against, you know, new discoveries, and then we don't have the language for it. So Neanderthals are extinct as a physically different species, you know, a species or a population walking around the earth that looks clearly different to us. They are gone, but their genetic legacy is still here because there was interbreeding, and there wasn't just one phase of interbreeding. It happened, we can see, multiple times, potentially in different places. We don't actually know where that happened, but there was enough interbreeding that some of the survivors of that sort of had their own children within Homo sapiens groups, and that's come down to us. So they're here and they're not here, in a sense. But in terms of what actually happened to them, why are they not still here walking around? And that obviously is like one of the biggest questions in archaeology, and I can't really give it to you the answer in 2 minutes. What I think we can say, rather than sort of giving answers, we can rule things out, I think, as key factors. One is that there wasn't just one cause. I think it's really obvious now that there's no simple cut and dried explanation for this. And also, it can't just be about the climate, because Neanderthals had dealt with really cold times before. They'd even dealt with periods when it was very unstable climate, as it was in the last sort of 10,000 years that they're around. It became really unstable. But they had coped with that before. So it has to be something else, I think. At the same time, people used to say, oh, well, maybe it's because Homo sapiens arrived and, you know, swept them out of the way, exactly as it's presented in The Inheritors. You know, these people are encountered, and in the book, devastation ensues immediately. Their society falls apart within 2 days. It's gone. You know, that's not actually what we see in terms of the archaeology either. We now know that Homo sapiens were dispersing from out of Africa way, way, way before the Neanderthals vanish. So there is no simple sort of cause and effect there either. It's not just about our presence. There may be things to do with better hunting technology, for example, and that's really interesting in The Inheritors as well, because those people have a bow and arrow. And until quite recently, that was probably thought to be inaccurate. But now we are thinking that, in fact, some of the later dispersing populations of Homo sapiens that were coming out of Africa maybe 55,000 years ago, they may have had bow and arrow technology. So perhaps that actually is part of it. And William Golding was maybe right about that. But also, it may be something to do with sort of population scale connectivity, which you don't really get a sense of that in The Inheritors, that it's a micro scale view in his book. Whereas what we think may be happening now is that although there's never very many people of either population, and the groups they lived in were probably, you know, just as small as each other, Homo sapiens people were probably better connected to each other. They had bigger social networks. And we certainly can see that genetically, their breeding populations look bigger. But also we might be able to see it in terms of the kind of objects that they have. There's a greater focus, as I was saying, on objects that we might think of as art or sort of symbolic, socially significant objects that could be exchanged between groups. So you put all of those things together and we're probably looking at something really complex. It could have lasted quite a long time. And also there may have been different processes and different triggers in different parts of that Neanderthal world, because they lived from where I am right now in Wales, down into the Mediterranean, into Northern Europe, right across into Siberia. It's a huge area.
The Inheritors is not the only novel to feature Neanderthals. It might be the best novel, the most classic novel. It's a modern classic. But there are others that have Neanderthal characters. The Clan of the Cave Bear from 1980, which was a popular sensation when it came out, comes to mind. There's another more recent book called The Last Neanderthal from 2017 by Claire Cameron. Rebecca, what can you say about this whole genre of caveman literature? How good is it? Do you recommend one of these books? Tell us a little bit about this sub genre of our literature.
Well, I would recommend all of them. I mean, The Inheritors, as you say, it's a classic. It's written from a very particular perspective. It has particular ideas it wants to communicate. It was a stunning book for its time, and it still is emotionally really quite impactful. The Clan of the Cave Bear, again, I think it's a great book. It's one of a series of novels written by Jean Al. She only finished them relatively recently. But that story kind of has some resonances with The Inheritors in that the Neanderthals in both of those novels are able to sort of communicate mentally with each other. The pictures that Golding talks about, these memories and sort of visual images they have, they're able to sort of share those mentally. And in the kind of the cave bear, you have something similar going on, that they can sort of, they held like a communal, almost like a species level memory. And they can tap into that. So I find that intriguing. And I do wonder, you know, how much Jean Earle might have sort of been inspired by some of Golding's ideas and then worked her own magic with them. But also kind of the cave bear is different because in this sense, rather than Neanderthal children being lost, it's a Homo sapiens child that's lost at the very beginning of this book. And it's her story. So she is the protagonist. Her name's Ayla. And you follow her sort of whole life through the whole series of novels. So that's kind of, it's almost got some similarities and some mirrors, and it's quite different. But stylistically, it's written completely differently. But what is wonderful about Jean Earle's novels is that she went to immense lengths to recreate the Pleistocene world, to really imagine what did it feel like to wake up in the morning on the icy steppe, you know, and what would you do? What were all the different things you had to do to survive? So that's fantastic. I love that. And then Claire Cameron's novel, I also really love this. I was very lucky she sent me an advance copy. It never actually was published in the UK, which is terrible. It really should be published here by somebody. Somebody should do it. But yeah, you should really get a hold of this because it's really fascinating to kind of see, well, as a genre, like you say, in its 21st century guise. This is a novel which has some similarities in that we are in the past with the Neanderthals, but at points we're also in the present. So it's like a parallel timeline book. And the present timeline, you're actually hearing about the story of an archaeologist, a woman archaeologist, and she's excavating a site, and it turns out that, you know, there's a link with the Neanderthals in the past, but she also has another story of her own that you kind of follow, very emotionally resonant. And then the story, the parallel timeline in the Pleistocene, I love it because it's intensely sort of drawn from the archaeology, from what we know and what we think about Neanderthals. And Claire has made a real effort to kind of weave that in. But it is much more resonant of Golding's style of writing in how he wrote The Inheritors, in that it's very internalized, sort of the imagery and the allusions. It's very kind of built around sort of metaphors that are strongly based in nature and in feelings and sort of, so that's fantastic. But there's also the fact that in this past timeline, it's about Neanderthals, but again, you have a meeting, a contact with the Homo sapiens, but very similar to the Inheritors, it's not made very obvious. You kind of gradually realize that that's what's happening. And it's very powerful for that reason as well. So I would really recommend that book too.
One more question as we wrap up. Your book, Kindred, is a great resource for anybody who wants to learn about the science of Neanderthals, what we know about them in the 2020s. But tell us, and maybe this is a two-part question, tell us, what drew you to the Neanderthals as a field of study? And what can we learn from them today?
Like a lot of archaeologists, I'm somebody who was interested in the past, you know, right back in childhood. And the Neanderthals and the Pleistocene world, so the Ice Age, Paleolithic archaeology, we would call that, that drew me more and more over time because of its challenge. It's difficult. You know, we don't have masses and masses of material evidence in the same way that people studying much more recent periods do. So we have to be very creative. And that's actually something I've tried to weave into writing my book. It's intended to be a definitive guide to the Neanderthals. What do we know about them? What do we think about them? What do we not know? But I've also tried to kind of show, you know, the threads of archaeological thought. And at the beginning of every chapter, I have narrative scenes, basically, where I'm coming from the perspective of somebody who knows the archaeology, who knows the data, and I use that to take a little step further to try and bridge that temporal gap and make inferences, come up with ideas and scenes about what it might have really been like. So I'm trying to sort of help people access the massive amounts of information we have as archaeologists, but also to help them actually connect with this really, really deep past that is part of everybody's heritage.
Rebecca Ragg Sykes, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Inheritors by William Golding.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is at heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.